From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. In this hour of the program, a glimpse of 21st century Vietnam. BBC journalist Bill Hayton is our guest. He says the country is in the midst of enormous social change driven by ambition and economic development. As it tries to maintain control, the Communist Party faces significant challenges. At the same time, the country finds itself with a wary eye on two superpowers, China and the U.S. Bill Hayton has written an engaging book on Vietnam today, the title, Vietnam Rising Dragon. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Bill Hayton is a reporter and producer with BBC News. He was the BBC's correspondent in Vietnam during 2006-2007. He has also written for The Times, The Financial Times, and The Bangkok Post. Bill Hayton's book, Vietnam, Rising Dragon, is published by Yale University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Bill Hayton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What are the signs of Vietnam as Rising Dragon?
Well, I suppose the numbers tell the story. I mean, it's only a quarter of a century since Vietnam really started its economic changes. And it's gone from being one of the poorest countries in the world to this year finally reaching the level of what's called middle-income status. So the average income in Vietnam is now reaching about $1,000 a year. And that puts them in a much higher category of country. And if you just have to go there, you just see just how booming the country is. On every street corner, you find traders and businesses of various kinds. People's lives are rapidly improving.
Vietnam officially describes itself, you report, as a socialist-oriented market economy. Is that an accurate description?
Well, it is. When you first get there, and certainly I found this, is that what I was just talking about, the vibrancy of street life and the din of everybody on motorbikes, and every tree seems to have a barber shop underneath it, or somebody offering to repair your motorbike or whatever. And you see this, clearly this looks like a bustling private sector economy, everybody, all these little small traders out for themselves. But when you look behind that, you discover that really you still have a very, very state-dominated economy. The big heavy industries, the banks, many of the raw materials industries like rice or growing or whatever, they're all very much state-dominated, even now. Even many of the big foreign investments in Vietnam, for example, there's a shoe factory, a single shoe factory that employs 32,000 people, for example, in Vietnam. And many of these operations are either state-owned or joint ventures with foreign countries and state-owned businesses. So the state still plays a very important role in the Vietnamese economy, although as there's been a very big scandal in Vietnam in the last few months about the state-owned shipbuilding industry, with investing in the wrong things, losing money, people being arrested. So that there are many, many problems hidden in the state sector, but it's still a very important part of the economy.
Is the equitable distribution of wealth a goal of the Communist Party of the state today?
It still is, but I think you can spot how it's changing just from the traffic in the cities. I used to say that Vietnam has socialist traffic. Many poor countries that you go to around the world, the poor people walk while the rich people speed past in their Mercedes Benzes. Whereas until very recently, everybody in Vietnam went around on a Honda Dream, on a little kind of two-stroke motorbike. And every family could either afford to buy one or borrow one or get a second-hand one. And as a result, the streets were completely clogged with noisy little motorbikes. But increasingly on the streets of Hanoi and Saigon in the south and elsewhere, you see the cars starting to arrive and clear signs that some people are getting richer faster than other people. But, you know, it is a key part of the Communist Party's legitimacy that it tries to share out some of the benefits of economic growth. The problem, I think, and I try and highlight in the book, is that well-connected people, I suppose it's the usual story in many developing countries, people connected to the ruling party are doing very, very well, and that is leaving a lot of people in their wake.
Hmm. You report that Vietnam has a low-tech but effective system of near-total surveillance. How does it work?
Well, it's a kind of curious mixture of traditional culture and values with an extra bit of Communist Party sort of surveillance on top. I mean, the traditional Vietnamese family is a very close-knit family, and you know, generations will live together in the same house, and grandfather will, you know, be the head of the family, and people will look up to him. What the party, the Communist Party, has done, and going right the way back to sort of 1950s and the start of the Communist rule in the North, has kind of been to co-opt that family into its surveillance structures. So typically a city is organized into neighborhoods of about 60 households each, and there's a warden appointed to monitor what goes on. Now, these people aren't just spies. I mean, they're traditionally kind of older people themselves, you know, often kind of grandfatherly figures. And their job is to not just keep an eye on what goes on, but also to kind of intervene and mediate and help people out. So they are kind of like the local good old boy in many cases. But they do have a surveillance role, and their job is to kind of nip problems in the bud, keep an eye on everybody and so forth. And they have this system, which it is starting to break down, but the system called the cultured family system. And culture, in this case, doesn't mean anything about reading books or liking opera. Cultured family means that you follow the state's laws. You are cultured. You are as the French might have said, evolved. You have high aspirations. You listen to the news on the on the radio or the television. And so forth. Yes, you can imagine a sort of certificate whereby, you know, we think you are a good citizen. And every year, the neighborhood gets around to decide who decides this, you know, who should get this certificate, whether you've been a good person, paid your taxes, followed the law and stuff. And you can imagine the kind of rows and things that could happen about, you know, who has been, causing the most noise on the block or whatever. So, I mean, it's a total system of, you know, observance and watching people. What's happening now, of course, is that with the free market, people can buy their way out of these systems.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to pay so much attention to them. In the old days, when the state controlled who got the food and who could have the license to do everything, then the power of the state was much, much stronger. But now, people are, you know, can do their own thing. They can break the rules to some extent if they've got a private source of income or whatever. They don't have to pay so much attention. So some of this stuff is breaking down, particularly in the cities, but it's still there. And if you do cause trouble, the party has, you know, very effective ways of keeping tabs on you.
Yeah. How has Vietnam handled the internet?
Slowly is the answer. I mean, it's only 13 years, I suppose. I think since Vietnam connected, they didn't really connect until 97. And they experiment. I mean, one of the things I've realized is that the Communist Party of Vietnam is an intelligent organization. I don't mean by that it's always coming up with the right answer or is always the cleverest answer, but it experiments. It tries things. It sees if they work, and then if it don't work, then they go and try something else. So with Facebook, they have tried this experiment where they didn't ban people looking at the site. They didn't stop you accessing it. But they took they blocked it through what's called the DNS system. So if in your browser, you type facebook.com in, and that the internet then finds the real computer that's on and then directs you to the appropriate website. But what they did was they took that link out of the Vietnamese internet servers so that you typed Facebook in and it didn't find anything.
Mm.
But people very quickly found a way around this. And what's happened, bizarrely, is that there were only a year or so ago, there were only about 40,000 users of Facebook in Vietnam. Now there are 1.5 million. And this sort of block seems to have completely failed. In fact, people have found a way around it. But there was a kind of rather bad attempt at trying to do sort of internet censorship. But at the same time, they have more clever ways of trying to get people to be more loyal citizens on the internet. So there's a website called Zing.vn, which is a sort of Vietnamese equivalent of Facebook, which interestingly is backed by an American venture capital company that's based in Hanoi. And that's almost, or maybe even sometimes more popular than Facebook. But it's a much more, because it's based in Vietnam, it's easier for the parties or the security authorities to step in should the content become too risky for the party. But there's no way they can control the whole internet. They don't know that. But, they will pick on certain people. Like, for example, only last week there was a blogger who made various allegations about the son of a minister and his private life and whether or not he was taking drugs and that sort of thing. Now, that person has been arrested and sentenced to prison. And I think that the strategy is when you find someone like that who makes very serious allegations, that you make an example of them to encourage the others. So the message goes out to the wider internet community, don't push this too far. You can go and play Farmville on Facebook or whatever, but don't start making allegations online about ministers or their children.
So this picture of the state of Vietnam, the Communist Party, that you're painting here, we have an effective government, we have a resilient government, we have an elastic state, but there have to be problems. What's the Achilles heel? Where are the problems with the state today? Where do they run into difficulty?
I think the problems are emerging from a few different directions, and the main two which are combined is this refusal to allow a really free press. I mean, they have a system of managing the media which has allowed a whole range of newspapers and magazines to exist. I mean, earlier this year, for example, Cosmopolitan started publishing its Vietnamese edition. And you can get magazines about golf and, home decoration and these sort of things, as well as the newspapers. But it's still very controlled. And if you go beyond certain limits, then there will be sanctions taken against the newspapers. So what's happening is that investigative reporting about problems in, for example, the big state-owned industries or corruption or whatever are kept very tamed. So they don't go above a certain level or they don't get to the real story. There's always a sense that the powerful people are getting off. And this means that problems like the one I was talking about at Vinashin, the big state-owned shipbuilding company, which ran up enormous debts, I mean, potentially nationally destabilizing debts. And, it stopped, concentrating on building ships, and it went and built breweries and hotels and property developments and things, all the time keeping the political backers sweet with, various forms of incentive. In the end, other state-owned industries had to be told to bail out the shipbuilding industry because it was in such a bad state. And these things, I think, are building up in many areas of life, but we're not finding out about them until it's too late, because the people that are in powerful positions are able to stop the media reporting about them and stop other people investigating them. And particularly when you have this combination of rich, connected people who are able to influence the media and have links between the party and the state sector and the private sector. And you're getting a bit like some other countries in Southeast Asia, these kind of ruling families at the top. They're in a position to kind of feather their own nest and stop criticism of what they're up to. And I think that's a real worry for Vietnam.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning in this portion of the program, BBC journalist Bill Hayton. He is the author of Vietnam, Rising Dragon. He's a reporter and producer with BBC News. He was the BBC's correspondent in Vietnam during 2006 2007. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. What was your experience as a member of the Foreign Press Corps in Vietnam?
Well, the Foreign Press Corps in Vietnam is very small. I mean, there were fewer than 10 of us, I think, at one stage, just mainly the news agencies and a couple of outlets. And it's probably even smaller now, I think. It's a funny place. I mean, I was very surprised when I first got there that I could literally walk out onto the streets of Hanoi with a camera and a microphone, and I could stop people in the street and ask them what they thought of anything, really. They wouldn't necessarily give me an answer if the topic was too controversial. You know, what do you think of the Communist Party? Isn't going to get you very far. But if it's, what do you think about, you know, the United States? I did that. What do you think about joining the World Trade Organization? I could get people to talk to me. But at the same time, I wasn't allowed to leave Hanoi for work without getting a permit from the authorities. And according to the press law, every single thing that a foreign journalist has to do in Vietnam has to be approved 5 days in advance. So when I was there, for example, you know, bird flu was a big story in Vietnam. But if I'd followed the law and I'd found out about a case of bird flu somewhere, in theory I would have to, you know, apply in writing to the foreign ministry for permission to then ring up a doctor in this part of the country and say, is it true that you've got bird flu and how many cases? So, and it's just impossible for a journalist to work like that. So, of course, everybody just breaks the law. And most of the time, there's no problem with doing that because that's how everybody operates in Vietnam. The law only really comes into effect when you really do something wrong that the Communist Party doesn't like. But if you overstep the mark, if you start doing stories about political dissidents, as I started to do towards the end, then you suddenly get reminded that you do need this 5 days permission, even though the previous week when you've been doing a story about the visit of some official or whatever, an anodyne story, you didn't need permission for that. So you would get into trouble, basically. So, for example, I did a story in the run-up to the Asia-Pacific summit that was held in Hanoi back in 2006 when President Bush came to Hanoi. I found out that a lot of the street children in Hanoi were being rounded up and taken to a kind of orphanage place outside the city center and held there basically while the summit was taking place so that they wouldn't bother the visitors. And I did a story about this. I did the research. And I was very rapidly pulled into the foreign ministry and reminded that I needed permission to do anything 5 days in advance. But when I was doing other stuff, no problem at all. So it's a kind of hands-off system of control, but when you cross the line, they come down on you really hard.
Mm. When you asked people about what they thought about the U.S., what kind of responses did you get?
It's mixed. It's and what I kind of came to realize is that there's an official line on many issues in Vietnam, and the authorities have means of kind of making sure that everybody knows what the official line is. I mean, at its crudest, on every street corner, there is literally a loudspeaker in Vietnam, and the local People's Committee, the local authorities, broadcast twice a day, morning and afternoon, local information, which, you know, might be as sort of useful as, you know, the post office is going to be closed this afternoon for repairs, or it'll be the latest party line on some matter of international affairs or the economy or whatever it is. And so often when you go and ask people something as controversial potentially as what do you think of the United States, they tell a script in response. And it's not that there's a government minder standing next to them, but you just get the sense they know what is acceptable to say. And so I think among an older generation who may, you know, who will remember the war and maybe feel more resentful or angry about it. But talking about people in the north here, I spent less time in the south. They, rather than say anything controversial, they'll say something anodyne or just keep silent. But among the younger people, I mean, and more than half of Vietnam's population is under the age of 25, so they have no personal memory of the war whatsoever. you find, I mean, a genuine enthusiasm for American youth culture, for hip-hop, for fashion, for, you know, and also for sort of economic entrepreneurialism. I mean, they're really dynamic entrepreneurs across Vietnam, and they look to the U.S. They see it as a kind of, as a beacon. When I was there, when Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, visited, and he came to speak at the one of the universities, and the place was packed. I mean, it was absolutely full of students who basically, were, I think, were there for kind of get-rich-tip-quicks. And you know, he was really, you know, impressive. He blew them away. He kind of he took his shirt off and he rolled his sleeves up, and rather than, you know, the classic, you know, Marxist-Leninist lecture that they might have received in their regular courses, you know, he walked up and down among the students and spoke to them, and it was a really, you know, engaging performance for these students, and they took him to their hearts. And I missed it, but Bill Gates had been there a little bit before, and there were so many people that climbed into the trees to see Bill Gates that the branches collapsed. You know, people fell out of the trees. I mean, it was kind of a rock star welcome. So this side of kind of American life, I suppose, this sort of, you know, the success and and youth culture is really very attractive to Vietnamese. I mean, it must be one of the few countries in the world where the American ambassador, you know, can literally, you know, ride around in a taxi, you know, without any worry of anybody, you know, stopping and doing something nasty to him. So it's given the history, it's a surprisingly positive attitude that many Vietnamese, certainly the young people, have towards the U.S. now.
Yeah. One of the things that you write about the young people in Vietnam is you say, you know, their idea of cool is one of their ideas of cool is to have disposable income. What do they spend it on?
Increasingly, the kind of things that I suppose that, you know, kids in America or Europe will spend them on. Motorbikes, very important. I mean, motorbike for Vietnamese is about freedom and no longer enough to have, you know, the Honda dream that your parents had. You've got to have something, you know, much sleeker and faster. Fashion, haircuts. I mean, it's kind of interesting the way that, for example, the hip-hop scene has mutated as it's gone around the world. And now I think, you know, hip-hop for Vietnamese isn't necessarily seen as an American thing as much as a sort of global youth thing, particularly, and Korean type. They look a lot towards Korea as a source of youth fashion as well. But, I mean, you have this, I mean, a very heady sense of optimism that this generation is going to do better than its parents did. And, you know, they are increasingly, I mean, the cliche is that all the kids go to internet cafes and search the internet from there. But increasingly, families have the money now to have computer connections at home, things that, you know, were not, even when I was there, you know, when I left 3 years ago, you know, it was very unusual to have computers at home, but now that's starting to happen. And very, very aspirational. So after hours, English language lessons, you know, everyone's, you know, looking for, you know, to rise up the ladder and to get a good job, you know, partly for themselves, but also it goes back to this thing about the family and kind of wanting to give something back to your parents. Very sort of close-knit traditional families wanting to honor the parents.
Mm-hmm. I have, thanks to you and your writing of Rising Dragon, I have this idea of the cities of Vietnam as being buzzing, vibrant places. But perhaps before we let too much more time go by, we should talk about the countryside, which you also write about in Rising Dragon. Who is left in rural Vietnam, and what is life like there today?
Well, the majority of the population still live in rural areas, although increasingly it's hard to be sure about that because areas are classified as rural or urban officially, and often what used to be a rural area a few years ago is being built on. And so it may be that, you know, it used to be a village, but it isn't any longer. But way more than half the population of Vietnam still lives in rural areas in the countryside. There is a great deal of inequality. I mean, if you want to stay poor in Vietnam, you stay in the village. If you want money, then you move to the towns, you move to the big shoe factories and assembly facilities and so forth. Intel, the American chip maker, has literally, I think it was yesterday, formally opened its billion-dollar chip factory in, just outside Ho Chi Minh City in the south. So just another major piece of foreign investment. And that's the kind of stuff which is sucking people from the villages into the cities. But Vietnam still has a system of controls. In theory, you have to have permission to move from your place of residence to any other place in the country. And you have to have a piece of paper signed by the authorities both where you live and where you want to go to. And if you don't have that piece, then your children can't get into the local school. In theory, you can't get married. You shouldn't be able to get a residence permit. All these kind of things really hurt people that try to move to the cities without permission, although millions of people are literally doing it and dodging the law. But it's another way that people in the countryside kind of feel a bit left behind. They're missing out on all this stuff. And you can, you know, it's easy to tell if you go to a village which families have got someone in the city because they've got a TV in their house and a motorbike out of the front. They're doing well. The other ones, who haven't got families that have moved are still kind of living, you know, kind of a decade or so in the past. And life is tough, I mean, for farmers. I mean, they have to, the south, life is a bit better, the climate is a bit better for growing crops and things. They can get more rice cultivation and that sort of thing. The center of the city, center of the country, you know, around Hue and Da Nang, the two big towns, cities in the middle, really, you know, the soil is very hard. Life is really very tough for people there. And being a farmer in those places is almost a guarantee of being poor. And then you have, I mean, in the mountains and in the central highlands, life more difficult again, even there, particularly because there, these are places that are where the ethnic minorities live, and you're increasingly getting kind of stories that are familiar from many parts of the world where the indigenous people are being left behind, and then settlers from the lowlands are moving in, doing very nicely, and you're getting real inequality between the majority population and the minorities up in the mountainous areas. So, I mean, that's so sensitive that I never got permission to go to the Central Highlands. It's a very sensitive issue for the Vietnamese authorities. I would have liked to have gone there and found out for myself, but just not possible.
Yeah. You say in Rising Dragon that land disputes are the hottest political issue in Vietnam. Two questions then. What are these disputes about, and what's at the root of them?
Well, land is money in Vietnam for some people, but land is also security for peasants. So, I mean, it's only a few years ago that the country was on the verge of famine. I mean, 79, Vietnam had to import rice to survive. People were literally kind of starving in places. Even in the end of the 80s, there was another sort of wobble on whether people had enough to eat. So holding on to land is a way that you can guarantee your family's survival, literally. You know, you grow the rice, you can feed your family. So losing land is quite a traumatic experience for people. But obviously, as you have industrial parks expanding or people want to build housing developments, then that's got to go somewhere. And so land is being taken from peasants and being given to developers. And if you happen to be the owner of the land, or you happen to be the person who can make the decision where the industrial park should be built, you can make an awful lot of money out of that. And so there have been many, many cases, I mean, hundreds, thousands across the country, where corrupt officials have been taking control of the land, kicking off the peasants that are working there, and turning it over for housing or for factories or whatever, and then paying either no compensation or minimal compensation to the people affected. And sometimes this can be dealt with locally, and some kind of solution can be worked out, but sometimes, increasingly often, you find people will take their protests to the streets of the cities, and they will literally camp out, blockade a street until they get some kind of justice. And I saw very vociferous and angry demonstrations about this when I was there. And it has a real capacity to undermine the Communist Party at the local level, because it's basically about some officials and business people making an awful lot of money and being corrupt and ripping off the ordinary folk in whose name they're supposed to be operating. So it's a really hot issue, and you're getting unrest, and the Communist Party knows this, and so in some cases it's actually trying. It knows that it has problems in certain places with the local officials being corrupt. So it's trying to get new ways of keeping an eye on those people, to the extent that they're now talking about having elections to local people's committees, local councils, local authorities in the villages, as a way of trying to control these corrupt officials. And it's stalled at the moment, but the idea is there. And it could be very interesting that the party may try and use democracy at the local level to try to bring its own officials, its own Communist Party officials, into line in the villages.
Hmm. What's the future for Vietnam's farming villages?
I think it's different in different places. I mean, who would really be a farmer in the central region of Vietnam if you had a choice? I mean, it's no way to really catch up with people living in the city. People down in the south in the Mekong Delta, it's sort of agro industry almost down there. You know, they're growing for export. Now, Vietnam is now the second largest exporter of rice in the world. It's a huge export crop for the country. But most of the exports come from the south. In the north, it's kind of subsistence way of life, a bit of trading. You can sell most of what you grow, but not all of it. But at the same time, that area is also industrializing rapidly. So I could kind of see that land being swallowed up by business parks and that kind of thing. So over the next coming a couple of decades, there's going to be a big migration. I mean, it already is. It's going to be even bigger migration of people to the cities, and the cities are going to double in size, and that's going to put an awful lot of strain on the cities. And I mean, if you go to Saigon now and look in the rivers and just see how polluted and stinking they are, imagine what it's going to be like if the population of the city doubles, they're going to have big issues to deal with in the next few years, I think.
Yeah. Here I am sitting in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, in the middle of the Midwest, and we're surrounded by farmland. And I'm wondering, with that view, what's Vietnam's potential as a market for our goods?
It's growing. I mean, the standard of living is rising, and everywhere that people's standard of living goes up, they like to vary their diets, try new foods and products and so forth. I don't have the figures, but I think the U.S. is now the largest investor in Vietnam. If you include American companies that are based in other parts of the world, for example, those that are based in Singapore that then invest in Vietnam, the U.S. is now the largest investor. As I was talking about Intel just a bit before, they're making stuff there, which I guess is not good news for American workers, but it's obviously good news for America as a company, for corporate America in terms of profits and so forth. But people want to buy consumer goods, and if they can be the right price, I suppose, for a relatively poor economy, then there are opportunities there. But I mean, Coca-Cola, an obvious brand that's very successful in Vietnam, but they're obviously. There's another very, very large manufacturing country that's a lot closer to Vietnam, which is China. And it's cheap Chinese plastic-made goods, which are sort of sustaining the consumer boom for the most part. Something that U.S. and Vietnam both have in common is a massive trade deficit with China. Vietnam is as worried about its trading relations with China as the U.S. is.
This is Focus, our guest this morning in this portion of the program, journalist Bill Hayton. He is the author of Vietnam Rising Dragon. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the discussion this morning. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener in Chicago on line four. Hello.
Good morning. I find this very interesting. I was wondering if you could ask your guest, or could I ask your guest, how does the average Vietnamese feel about America, considering all the ordnance we dropped on that country? And is this still a problem for Vietnam? Are they still digging up all of this weaponry? And how do they feel about it in the United States?
Shall I answer that directly?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, on the second thing, yes, they definitely are still digging up ordnance, particularly in the central region of Vietnam. And from time to time, there are still very tragic stories about children that are killed whilst either accidentally or, in some cases, deliberately coming across ordnance. I mean, there are people, I mean, literally, who make a living from digging up unexploded shells. And
well, I was surprised to find out that we dropped more bombs on the country during the war than we did on Japan during the World War II.
I mean, just vast amounts. I mean, I think, Laos next door is the most heavily bombed country per head of population, but Vietnam was not far behind. And you've still got this, huge legacy now, and people are often killed trying to turn this stuff into scrap metal. And this doesn't account of, and there's also the whole legacy of Agent Orange and dioxin poisoning in many parts of Vietnam, which is another hugely devastating legacy of the conflict. But I mean, these are very issues, very live issues for many, many families across Vietnam, mainly in the center and the south. But at the same time, you kind of have this young, optimistic outlook on the world. And it's hard for me to say whether truly the average Vietnamese person bears a grudge against the U.S. I mean, my feeling is the older generation does but can't talk about it. But the younger generation don't seem to have inherited their parents' feelings. And it's obviously different in the North and in the South, because obviously the South had much closer contact with Americans. And
It's been 35 years. It's hard to believe it's been that long. But there are people around today who don't even remember the war, so I would imagine that generation probably doesn't have too much antagonism.
Yeah, but I mean, in the generations, in the U.S. here, I mean, still have very vivid memories, even if they don't have personal contact. Memories are being transmitted, through...
Well, that's true. We found that true in our own Civil War, so I guess you're right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a complex picture, but I think my general feeling is that people are looking to the future.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, Bill, that in your book at the outset, you talk about how politically charged in the United States, we pack all kinds of baggage into Vietnam.
If you go to a news site on the internet and just type in the word Vietnam, the vast majority of the stories will have absolutely nothing to do with Vietnam whatsoever. You'll find a motorist in a road accident being described as a Vietnam veteran, or you'll describe a piece of legislation will be described as Vietnam era legislation, and these things obviously mean a great deal to Americans. It's a form of shorthand, for a particular time and place or a particular kind of person or whatever. It must be incredibly difficult for anybody from that, who was active and involved in around that time. I think, and even newer generations now, to kind of look at Vietnam just as a country, as people there think about it themselves. I mean, I kind of find it a bit strange for me as a non-American, non-Vietnamese sort of writing on this, because for me the cultural meaning is different. I mean, it was not as nowhere near as controversial an issue in Britain as it was in the U.S. and still is. I mean, you see the debates now about the war still going on, 35 years later from what should have been done or shouldn't have been done. partly, I suppose, because of what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. But these things, you know, it has a life. It still can, these battles, you know, these intellectual, cultural battles in the States are still being fought, and I hesitate before, you know, saying anything at all about them.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign County on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. On the subject of, not so much the personal remembrance of the conflict, but on the institutional level, I think the Vietnamese government does proceed, and there have been some unofficial kind of proto-judicial hearings. I think the president of the National Lawyers Guild here in the U.S. participated in, you know, sort of an assessment of the ramifications of the ecological warfare of Vietnam and the effects of dioxin and all of this. There's still a lot of no-go, no agricultural zones. There's still a lot of that, and that's a living legacy. I don't know how much youth would talk about that, but the fact that a person of, you know, like Marjorie Cohn can write about it, and it just isn't discussed here. I don't know if it came up. I haven't been actually listening as closely as I should have, but I didn't.
We haven't talked that much about Agent Orange and dioxin, but I mean, it's only in the last 3 years that there have been serious attempts between the governments of the U.S. and Vietnam to make some progress on this. And increasingly, I mean, actually, an awful lot of the running has been done not by the governments, but by a couple of foundations. So that the Ford Foundation and the Aspen Institute have themselves been doing most of the, you know, the work on Agent Orange and trying to get some progress. The problem, of course, is that whereas, I mean, you have the government and you also have the companies that made Agent Orange and the other herbicides. And there has been a court case in the U.S. against them. The problem with the court case was it seemed to argue that the chemicals were used as weapons and deliberately hurt the people, whereas it was fairly easy for the defense to say that that wasn't the case. But there's obviously a separate case about whether there should be compensation paid to people who were affected in Vietnam. Because, I mean, compensation is paid to American veterans who can show that they suffer from symptoms of poisoning. But there's nothing being paid to Vietnamese people. Where the American government is now doing something is in places where Agent Orange and the other herbicides were stored and then leaked into the soil. So there's a few places. So in the central city of Da Nang, at the end of the airport runway, there was a massive storage facility there. And the levels of dioxin in the soil, even now, you know, 35 years after the end of the war, are still deadly to human and animal life. So they're, you know, spending, I think, $3 million cleaning up that place. But it's fairly straightforward to go to a place where there is poison in the soil and say, look, we need to do something about this. And that's what's happening. It's much more difficult to go and say to somebody who was poisoned 35 years ago and whose children are being affected now with genetic disorders and say, you know, conclusively, this is because you were sprayed with Agent Orange or whatever, or you ate food that was contaminated with it or however it might have happened, and then to make some kind of claim for compensation. So it's a very big issue. Very difficult to see how it's going to go forward, because obviously neither the U.S. government nor the chemical companies want to admit liability for potentially, you know, tens of thousands of people that might claim some kind of injury. So it's very, very small steps at the moment. But it's a controversial issue, and it would be one that if a government here or, you know, could make some steps on it, would be so warmly welcomed in Vietnam, because the consequences for people who have been poisoned by a dioxin are terrible. I mean, children born without eyes or extra joints in their limbs, severely disabled. I mean, these are the many, many, the worst cases of poisoning. And, you know, it's a live issue in Vietnam, and it's one that does still rankle.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign. Line two, hi.
Hi. Totally different topic. I was wondering if the guest had any information about maybe conservation or parks or anything that they might have in Vietnam. I don't know, I just have seen pictures of it, you know, on specials on TV and stuff, and this seems like a really beautiful country, and I was wondering if they had any active programs to kind of preserve that heritage of the jungles.
Vietnam is a fantastically beautiful country, I mean, in many, many places. Get away from the cities themselves are interesting, but in many cases they're not beautiful, but they get away and into the mountains and more remote areas, it's fantastically beautiful. And yes, there is a system of national parks, and Vietnam has signed all the right bits of paper about conservation and biodiversity and all that sort of that side of the environmental agenda. But the problem is on implementation, and particularly things like wildlife trade. And, you know, sadly, Vietnamese and Chinese do like eating, you know, rare and endangered animals, you know, pangolins, snakes, whatever. They are often served up in restaurants, and so there's a big problem with wildlife trade. They've been much better about preserving certain places. Although, again, there's an illegal timber trade which has devastated many parts of the mountains. But there are sort of environmental groups now in Vietnam. There's a group called Education for Nature Vietnam, another group called Wildlife Action. I think the acronym is WAR, in fact. And they are trying to do a lot to stop wildlife trafficking, to preserve the national parks. And, of course, the more that people, you know, go and see these national parks, the more local people will realize that preserving them is a good way to, you know, to bring income into their areas and so forth. And, I mean, almost every week, it seems, some new species is discovered in Vietnam. I mean, there are, you know, very, very rare and endangered animals that are, you know, never been seen before, that are now, you know, still are being discovered the more that scientists get in and do some research there. So it's a fabulously, you know, rich, diverse environment, and it really does need to be protected.
Mm. A listener want to follow up?
No, thank you. That was very good. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call this morning. And actually, what we had been talking about in terms of pollution and poisons, I think that the caller's question is kind of a nice follow-on, because I wonder here at this point if these efforts at conservation and in awareness about environmental issues would lead to a sensitivity in cities about pollution.
It would be nice to think so, but I mean, I think people are, you know, so focused
on the day-to-day, yeah,
and speed and getting around town in your motorbike and stuff, that like many parts of the world, it's, you know, the consequences have been ignored. I can remember one summer day in Hanoi, and there had been a torrential downpour with monsoon rain, and I was you know, going along on the back of a motorbike, and I suddenly noticed you could see hills all around the city, and I thought, I've never noticed those hills before. The reason was because the rain had just cleared all the soot and the smog out of the sky, and these, you know, these hills were only, you know, 20 miles away, but I'd never seen them before, because you know, the pollution is just so bad in Hanoi, and getting worse in the other cities too.
Yeah. We're rapidly coming down to the point where we have to wrap up. We haven't really talked about relations between China and Vietnam. Where do they stand? This is an important question.
It is, and I think that trying to make Vietnam choose between the U.S. and China is bound to fail. There's no way that the country can develop without the support of both countries. I mean, it would be like asking Mexico to ignore the U.S. or something. You know, you've got a superpower on your northern border. You've got to have, you know, good relations with it. The problem for Vietnam is that the country and the people almost define themselves in opposition to China. If you go to any city in Vietnam, the main streets are all named after either myths or you know, real historical figures who fought against the Chinese. And although the culture is so obviously Sinitic, so obviously related to China, I mean, the words you use have Chinese roots, the religion and the culture and so forth obviously has Chinese roots, and up to 1,000 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to tell where China stopped and what's now Vietnam, you know, began. It was all a very similar culture. In the last 1,000 years, you know, the Vietnamese have
had an independent country to some extent, although that's kind of cutting a long story very, very short indeed. But now there is a sense that this worry about China is getting bigger and bigger. And it's partly been in the last few months been exacerbated by through discussions on the internet about what China's intentions towards Vietnam are. And the two main issues are what's going on in the South China Sea between the two countries, and also plans that China has to build dams on the top of the Mekong River, which would have massive consequences for the countries downstream. And also, there was a decision to give a Chinese company the right to mine bauxite, aluminium ore, in the Central Highlands. And this has proved to be massively controversial, and people in Vietnam getting very angry about it and causing all kinds of political problems. Mm. But the South China Sea is an area that the U.S. is getting very interested in because it's a major international shipping lane. There are oil companies prospecting for oil there. ExxonMobil and BP were both working in Vietnamese waters, and the Chinese told them not to, and they both made their excuses and left, and the U.S. government was concerned about that. And there are two groups of islands which the U.S. and Vietnam claim. And in the last couple of years, the Chinese have declared that they own the entire South China Sea all the way to the coast of Vietnam and Malaysia and the Philippines. And the Vietnamese have protested about this. And it's been going backwards and forwards. And every time the Chinese do something, the Vietnamese have sort of protested. But this summer, they invited the USS George Washington, American aircraft carrier, to come and make a visit to Vietnam with the obvious symbolism, we are getting closer to the U.S. And Vietnam is not at the stage where it's going to, become an ally of the U.S. or a partner against China. But it's weighing up its options very carefully, thinking, in the future, will we need the U.S. to help us if we ever get involved in a confrontation with China?
There we have to leave it. We are out of time. Bill Hayton, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bill Hayton is the author of Vietnam, Rising Dragon. The book is published by Yale University Press.